Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Have you ever gotten robocalls or mail saying that you're pre-approved for loans or credit cards? Oh, if you have, let me just tell you that thieves, both foreign and domestic, may have you in their sights. And it's the equity in your home, believe it or not, that they want. Well, it's called home title fraud. It's one of the fastest growing crimes in the United States. And it's where thieves are after your money and they get it by forging your home's title. So it ends up looking like you sold your home, even though you didn't. Then they'll take out loans against your home and stick you with all the payments. It's a nightmare. No insurance, bank, or identity theft program protects you, though. But Home Title Lock does. For pennies a day, Home Title Lock puts a barrier around your home's online title and mortgage, and it helps keep thieves away. Again, if you've received robocalls or mail for pre-approved credit cards or loans, you need to move fast. You can receive 60 risk-free days of Home Title Lock protection now by going to HomeTitleLock.com. Register your address to verify that you're not already a victim. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the Best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. I want to thank all of our sponsors, ADT Home Security, Pluto TV, Delta Animal Rescue, and Home Title Lock. All right, we're back on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Oh, we got a lot to get to today. And make sure you subscribe. Go to Podcast One or anywhere you hear podcasts. You like to listen to podcasts. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And we're a huge reaction to this podcast. I mean, we're just so grateful, and tell your friends. And it's politics, the culture, and beyond. We decode the culture for you and have a fun time doing it. There's no point in being dour and negative and down, and we all fall into that trap, and it is a trap. We look at the world as it is and not in some utopian way, and try to bring first principles, essential truths, basic truths back to the fore. And one of the basic truths that I think has been muddled in recent years, really it's been going on for probably two decades to be exact, maybe even more. Christina Hoff Sommers wrote this book almost 20 years ago called The War Against Boys. And people thought, oh, come on, war against, what do you mean war against boys? Well, she pointed out that the rates of suicide, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, depression, despondency, alienation from family for men had been rising at an unacceptable rate, and that boys, especially in the classroom, were being given short shrift and shortchanged. And why this has been happening and what this does to a culture when men feel emasculated. Now, we arrive at this point now, and we find that even the word masculinity is under attack, because you can't say that masculinity means strength, physical strength, or strength of traditionally minded character. You can't say that, because that's putting men in a box. That's not allowing men to be in touch with their feminine side. And now with the idea of gender morphing from one to the next, which itself is a lie, because biologically, just physiologically, you can't change your genetic makeup. Okay, can't do that. You can mess around with things, and you could take hormones and do that, but your physical appearance changing does not mean that you ultimately are able to change your sex that you were born with. That's just impossible. But you do other things. So it's all become very fluid. So it's called gender fluidity. Well, what does this end up doing to our boys? And how has this affected boys today? They're struggling. They're still struggling. And what can we do about it? Well, there's a book that's really interesting. It's called The Boy Crisis. Warren Farrell, who's the author of The Myth of Male Power, and John Gray, he wrote the book Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus. They wrote this book together. And, of course, Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus was a global bestseller, number one bestseller, one of the best-selling books, I think, of all time. But we're joined today by Dr. Farrell, who's going to shed light on what's happened in all those years since the War Against Boys came out, what's happened in the last 20 years, and what can we practically do about it as adults, as parents, as grandparents. And a lot of young people are listening to this podcast as well. What can we do as moving forward, not just complaining about what's happened? Dr. Farrell, it's good to talk to you. Are you feeling particularly toxic and masculine today?
Oh, every day, my toxicity.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think we all probably have to work on the toxicity part. I know I do. Let's talk about where we are. I mean, when you say there's a boy crisis, please explain what that means.
Yes, I found that that boys in all 63 of the largest developed nations are falling behind girls in every single academic subject, and especially in reading and writing. And reading and writing are the two biggest predictors of success or failure. And so that really got my curiosity up, what was happening in these developed nations, and why were boys feeling, falling so far behind. I also found that the boys were falling behind in terms of their life expectancy is actually going down. That's the first time in recent history that the life expectancy of any group of people has gone down. Girls' life expectancy is remaining about the same recently, but boys is going down. So I was concerned with that. I was seeing that boys were dying from drug overdoses and opioid addiction at twice the rate of girls. I saw that when boys and girls were 14, they rarely committed suicide, and they committed suicide when they did. It was about equal, boys and girls. But so I started looking at that and realized that when they were from 15 to 19, the boys' suicide rate was twice that of girls between 20 and 24. The boys' suicide rate had gone to almost six times that of girls.
Oh my God.
And so I saw that as as testosterone increased and the males were taking on this a role that they didn't feel that they were not feeling clear about, that they didn't know whether, since the Boy Crisis book has come out, dads and moms have written me, like, in seventh grade, the boys are learning that, masculinity is toxic, that they are part of the patriarchy, that they are have male power. And they're told that when they start feeling, and they start explaining, they say, well, what's toxic about masculinity? And the teachers will say, well, boys and men don't express their feelings. So my son starts expressing his feelings that he feels like it's not all about male power, because he feels like his dad is really working extremely hard, driving an Uber or, collecting garbage or doing something that he doesn't see as being that much about power and privilege. And he's told he's mansplaining. And so he goes, wait a minute, Dad and Mom, one minute I'm told I'm not expressing my feelings. And the next minute when I do express my feelings, I'm told I'm mansplaining. And then he gets a little
bit. So they don't understand. So let me hop in here. So what you're describing is that with the cultural and sociological changes and the pressure put on men to be, I don't want to say sensitive because I like a sensitive man, but to be suspicious of their instincts, that is part of the reason why they're committing suicide. That seems like a big leap because people are calling them toxic. Feminists calling them toxic. You got celebrities kind of doing the demonization. You got Gillette ad making all men out to be beasts. So that's the kind of thing that's making them feel despondent?
No, that's just one contributor in that direction. The single biggest contributor, probably that leads to more problems for boys than any other single thing, and girls, by the way, too, is a lack of boundary enforcement, and also not creating enough of a bond with their parents by doing. And this is something that any mother, any father can do. There's really, most mothers contribute what I call mom-style parenting. and they really get in there and they care for their children, they do for their children, they nurture their children. But particularly when a mom is parenting by herself, she needs to incorporate both the mom-style parenting with the dad-style parenting. And there's two forms of dad-style parenting that are most likely to keep boys and girls really focused. One is boundary enforcement, and the second is creating a bond with the children by doing with the children. So instead of taking children to the playground, which is obviously a positive, but rather than looking at the iPhone while the children are doing their thing, it's doing with the children at the playground. Instead of playing soccer and watching the children play soccer, it's playing soccer with the children. Instead of like making sure the children win as they're playing soccer every time, it's having them win when they're really making a good effort and lose when they're not making a good effort. It's letting children make mistakes within the limit of, you know, not obviously dying and things like that, but making mistakes, getting lost, teasing with kids, playing hide and seek with kids. These are all things that create a bond. Once the bond is created, then boundaries can be enforced without creating a resentment and then anger towards the parent.
I love this. I love this. It seems like it's common sense, but I'm telling you from my own life, and it seems like it's gone by so fast with just the kids, and I know every parent says that, but I have a 13.5-year-old, a 10.5, and an 8.5. Okay?
Wow.
So I'm in the thick of it. Now, a couple days ago, it was really warm weather in Washington, and I'm a big sports person. I like to watch sports, but I like to play sports. So I said, and my kids are very physical. The boys are physical. One's really skinny. He's really skinny, all legs. And the other one, Nico, is like a real brute, the young one. So I said, get the football, because we like to kick the football together. We kick and then we do touch football, but just the three of us. So it's kind of, it's fun. But we did it, and I looked at my watch. I'm like, oh, my God, I've got to get going for my show. My show starts at 10 p.m. Okay, but I got to leave around 7:30 every night, you know? So I got a lot of people helping me. It takes a village in my house. But it was so my kids were like, Mom, keep playing, keep playing. And I literally flashed forward in my mind to, like, their wedding day. And I was thinking, I forget taking it. I took my son to the Super Bowl. That was fun. It's a memory, but being with them and doing it, real activity, is what they're going to remember.
You are absolutely right.
And I don't think I've done that enough. I mean, I've done it a lot, but I'm kicking myself because I don't think I did it enough with my daughter. I was one of those mothers at the playground on my iPhone when she was swinging in the swings at times. I was one of those mothers. And I'm embarrassed to say. I mean, I didn't do it all the time, but I did it some of the time.
So recognizing and acknowledging it is the first step in that direction. And, you know, we've always heard that, you know, at the end of a life, someone's on their deathbed and they never say, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. They almost always say, I wish I'd spent more time with my children. I wish especially I'd spent more time when they're younger. And, and it's really important for, I think, moms to know that, you know, that roughhousing, getting down there, playing with, that allows you to help the children, you know, when one of your children is being rough with the other child, too rough, and you stop the roughhousing and say, okay, you know, you can't do that. You can't put your elbow in your brother's or sister's face. That's not okay. And if you continue doing that, there'll be no more roughhousing for tonight. And so then the kids get caught in what psychologists call emotional intelligence under fire. And once they're excited, they go back to doing the thing that makes them win again. And so you stop the roughhousing. And then the children know the next night that when you say you can't, you know, put your elbow in your sister's face, that means something.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is, and you write in the book, and we're talking about the boy crisis, and you would not know by watching the dominant media, they only talk about boys being the problem. Boys' aggression, that's the problem. Boys are the problem. Boys aren't in crisis. Boys are the problem. But this book kind of really lays it out and why it's important as adults that we put ourselves out there to help guide young people into making good choices by being active mentors And my kids laugh at me because I'm a single mother. So I'm a single mom. So I'm having to be the nurturer and the disciplinarian. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to whine about it. This is my choice. And they're wonderful adopted kids from Russia and Guatemala. And I mean, they're my whole life. And they're just awesome. They're awesome and they drive me crazy, but we laugh. I said, you guys are driving me crazy. And so I'm always saying to myself, Dr. Farrell, okay, how I have to hug a little and be strong at the same. You got to hug, lots of hugging, but lots of line drawing.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Yes, it's hard to do both. That's why it's great, best to have two parents. It's hard to do both as one person. But I try. But we're like having pillow fights last night. You know, Nico hit me in the face, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have a swollen face going to TV. So we have a pillow fight, and we call it bra. Okay, it's called bra because I come around a corner. I go, bra! So they say, can we play bra tonight? I'm like, okay, only if you're good. And so, but they remember, they'll never forget that. That is what they will remember about growing up is the big pillow fights we have.
You're exactly right. You mentioned something too here too. And I want to really be very constructive for moms, especially single moms here.
Yep.
And also talk a little bit about Valentine's Day, if I may.
Yes.
You mentioned a little bit about mentoring. One of the best things you can do for your children is to find a good, solid male mentor. But even more important is finding someone your children can mentor. The development of character and responsibility for children, the likelihood of them not getting into the drug addiction we talked about, and the depression and the withdrawal that leads to the feeling alienated and the drug addictions and the mass shootings and so on. This is very much helped by your child having a mentor, because when your child has a mentor, he or she starts to look at everything she or he does as to, would this serve the person I'm mentoring well? And so you start developing the type of maturity that a parent develops. Another thing that's really important that has proven itself out is getting your children involved in faith-based communities where there's a really good male minister, priest, or rabbi, and where that faith-based community, the faith-based community leader organizes groups of boys, especially for your son, boys that that can talk to other boys about the things that are going on inside of them that are bothering them, that boys oftentimes don't give each other permission to talk about, that leads to boys doing relationship breakups are far more damaging to boys than they are to girls, because boys keep it all to themselves. Girls talk to other girls with it. Another major area is family dinner nights. Having those family dinner nights in single-parent families is really not just important for the family dinner night, but knowing the guidelines that it takes to not have that family dinner night become a family dinner nightmare.
And
one of the key issues...
That sounds like my growing up, family dinner nightmare. We're talking to Dr. Warren Farrell. The book is The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It. This book, I've got to say, I've gotten through only about a third of it, but I'm a fast reader. I skipped through I'm on chapter 24, Emotional Intelligence and Mental Health. And you have to read this book. You know, I know you hear people say that, but this for a parent, a grandparent, a mentor, a would-be mentor. And we all need to mentor people in our own ways. And I don't think many times I'm not a good mentor because I'm impatient, and it's my worst fault. I say this all the time, and I pray for patience. So I'm not a good mentor, but you know what I'm finding out, doctor? I'm not meaning to make this about myself, but it's a way I think I can relate to it and help our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
When I'm a really good sports mentor, okay, I'm really good sports and writing. I'm a pretty darn good writer, and I'm a good athlete. So I try to stay away from the things I'm not good at, which like math, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not good at mentoring on studying for math, and I'm not, but I'm good on the stuff I'm good at. That's what I try to connect with. Does that make sense? And I stay away from the stuff I'm not good at.
As long as you're not taking the things that you're good at and doing them for the children.
Right.
So like if you're a good cook, it's really important for you not to cook for children, but to cook with the children, assigning responsibilities. And if the kids screw it up, letting them eat the consequences without shame.
That's absolutely hilarious. ADHD. We got to hit ADHD because this is something that we as parents have seen the rise of for many, many years. The medicated society, people rushing to Adderalls now being sold per pill on a per pill basis on college campuses, advanced learning centers of med school, law school. I'd never heard of it until I was out of law school. I'd never heard of Adderall. Never heard of it in my life. Now it's people, oh yeah, my son's on Adderall. And I'm not going to question any parent's judgment on that, but we're talking methamphetamine for kids. Where are we there?
Yes. John Gray wrote the chapters on the book on ADHD and what to do to prevent ADHD, but also to prevent your children from being involved with drugs. And boy, it is amazing. So some real quickies. First of all, get your children involved in sports. Make sure they don't have the option to be active physically every day. They have the expectation that you enforce that as part of your parenting is to get kids physically active every day, and not just playing baseball where it's only about a third of a sport, but, you know, like basketball, we are constantly running, constantly moving, lifting weights, that type of thing. Making sure your children are not eating sugars, not eating carbs. So focus in on that part of the book where it talks about all the things that you need to feed the children, do for the children, so that they develop their own immune system that isn't dopamine dependent, based on something that is false, like video game addiction or porn addiction. That's really important. Another, if I may switch for a little bit to Valentine's Day, something, because something that is so crucial for children is knowing how to appreciate. Most kids think of, you know, they focus on falling in love, and falling in love is biologically natural. But sustaining love is biologically unnatural because sustaining love requires our being able to handle criticism. And biologically, we're not prone to being able to handle criticism without becoming defensive. And so knowing how to do that is a very important dimension of sustaining love. The other important dimension is knowing how to be to give appreciations. Many people say, like, you know, Mom, that was a great dinner you made. And teaching our children to say, Mom, I really love the way that you got the turkey skin so crisp and the dressing so moist. And how did you do that? And so what you're teaching your children is being more specific about the appreciation, because when you hear your child say, the skin's so crisp and the dressing's so moist, you realize it's not just a compliment. You feel like you were seen. The efforts you made were seen and felt and tasted by your children. And the how do you do that, did you do that question, shows a curiosity and an interest that really allows the person that's being appreciated to feel appreciated.
You know, those are some tips of being grateful, but not general about your gratitude. Generalized gratitude. And again, I'm going back to my own personal circumstance, which probably people are really bored of by now, but I think it's kind of interesting. So every time we go somewhere, if we stay with somebody, we have dinner, they take us out on their boat. You know, I have a lot of friends who've done really well, and I'm very grateful for their friendship if it comes to people, but I think maybe people just take pity on us. I don't know, doctor, but it's like, come on our boat. So the kids have had a lot of nice experiences. But I say to them, we get home. The first thing you do is I want to see that thank you note. And the other day, Dimitri had written a thank you note. Now, this was for a fishing trip we went on. It was spectacular. I mean, you can't even imagine. I've never been on it. I said, when I was little, my big vacation was going to the above ground pool of my friend Pam. It was about a postage stamp, and we dunked in that. That was it. That was my vacation. So I see. Thank you for having us on your boat. It was fun. Love, Dimitri. And I looked at him and I said, "Okay, where's your thank you note?" He's like, "There it is." I said, "Where's your thank you note?" And he had to rip it up, and he said, "Tell me about the trip. What did you like? What about that fish when you grabbed it and it slipped out of your hands?" I said, "Let's paint the picture of why this was a meaningful trip for you." And it took me 45 minutes almost 45 minutes with him because he was so mad that he had to spend the time. But I'm telling you something, that time that you invest now, he will not forget that. And their letters are better. Their thank you letters, thank you notes are better. And I hope they continue to get better. But the easy thing for me was to say, okay, good, put it in the mail, slap a stamp on it, send it off, and you're done. Check. But you can't do that, in my view. Doctor, I'll let you close it out.
For me, if the listener only heard what you just said, that was a great takeaway. That's exactly the type of difference between, it is so easy to parent by, okay, check it off, but teaching that child, teaching your son or daughter how to appreciate specifically, how to review their day and thank the person for every dimension of that. That's a thank you note. I was working with the woman who became my wife on doing that with her dad. And when I went to her dad's house, each of the appreciation notes that she wrote to him were framed on her dad's wall. And it was like the first time the dad had really felt appreciated in such a specific way. The other dimension of that is making love is about not just an art; it's also about a discipline. And what you explained there in your example is the discipline of doing it again, and also the discipline of sharing appreciations. At say maybe every Monday's dinner, or like every Monday at dinner, we go around the table and we share appreciations, and we share it in a very specific way. And we share it in a way that expresses curiosity, like, how did you cook the turkey to get the skin so crisp?
You're hungry. You're talking about that turkey a lot, Doc. You're he's like, I can say this. Dr. Warren Farrell loves crispy skin turkey. Okay, that man loves
turkey. Oh, my goodness, you found me out.
Yeah, I mean, I could be a psychologist, okay, because that's what I've been doing for 20 years in the media. I love this book. I love the fact that you spent so much time with us, and I'm so glad that there's a resource. It's kind of a Bible for parents in a very, very pressure-filled time for boys. There's a lot coming at them, but really a lot of this is simply understood. And if it's like sports, so going back to sports, you have to swing a tennis racket 10,000 times to get that forehand down. I mean, to really get a great forehand, the athletes say it's about 10,000 times. You got to do it over and over and over. Tiger Woods said the same thing. The swing has to be over, and you just got to keep doing it. And Dr. Farrell, thank you so much. And I want to remind everybody who's been listening to this podcast about the great skincare products that our friends at Chamonix, they put together with incredible compounds. And one that you guys seem to just love, and I'm so happy about it, is the Genucel's amazing, amazing new jawline treatment. Now, a jawline, your neck, that's kind of sensitive skin. You want the MDL technology, the proprietary base, the brand new treatment that helps get your skin back to looking tighter, healthier, younger looking. Cheryl from Fort Wayne, Indiana loves it. She said she's been using it for a week. She says the results are visible and her jawline looks so much better, even younger. Smiley face. All right, well, love it. Keep sending us all of these comments, and I love to read them, and I'll continue to share them with all of you out there. Remember, it's just genucel.com. That's genucel.com. You get 100% of your money back, no questions asked, if you don't like the results, but you will, I'm telling you. But it's a great deal and just great guarantee. So you order now and you get the Genucel for bags and puffiness, also free with your order. And also the Genucel immediate effects, also free. So there's no time but the present to get the best skin possible with the Genucel line of products. That's GENUCEL.com and two free gifts and express shipping at Genucel.com. Everyone loves summer, except when it comes to sleeping, because there's nothing worse than ruining a great night's sleep in these heat-trapping sheets with no way to get cool. Well, you want to stay dry. You want to get your rest. That's why I use Sheeks. Sheeks' patented sleep tech fabrics breathe 10 times better than traditional cotton sheets to keep you cool. They draw moisture away from the body to keep you dry, ensuring a deeper, more restorative night's sleep. Nothing compares to the comfort of Sheeks. The softness, unbelievable. And you're going to wake up feeling recharged and ready for a great day. So don't worry if you have a large bed. Sheeks come with deep pockets, so they'll fit any mattress perfectly. So what are you waiting for? Visit trysheeks.com/Laura and use the promo code Laura, you'll get 25% off your purchase. Plus, you'll receive free shipping, a bonus pair of pillowcases, and a 30-night risk-free guarantee. That's tryshex.com/Laura, code Laura. tryshex.com/Laura, code Laura. This is the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. Our next guest, Tommy Lahren, has just torn up the internet. Is one of the most followed and watched young conservatives on the scene today. She's a Fox News contributor. She has a great show on Fox Nation. And her book, Never Play Dead, How the Truth Makes You Unstoppable. Tommy Lahren is with us now. Tommy, how you doing, girl? Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. You know, Laura, I've been following you for years, and you are certainly one of my inspirations. So this is kind of a dream come true for me to be able to talk about my book with you.
Well, we're so excited and so excited for your success. And the one thing that I think you have as a young conservative voice is guts. I mean, you have guts and grit, and you bother to do this thing that some people on TV don't do, which is read and know history and understand, you know, what we're facing as a country. And your book is about using those bold ideas of conservatism in the public forum and never being cowed by the left, despite the attacks on you. And they do the same thing to me. Despite the attacks on you, despite the hits on you, you just have to stay unbowed in your truth and your journey. Tell us about it.
Well, you have to. And, you know this, you know, better than I do, that if the left thinks they can intimidate you, they will. And if they think that they can label you into silence, they will. And once you've set the precedent that they're unable to do that, whether it be in the professional forum or even in college campuses or with your family or your friends, then people stop bullying you, or at least it doesn't have an impact on you anymore, and your voice can get louder, which is what I've been able to do in my career.
And Tommy, this was a moment that I know you're going to be talking about, a Q&A on Al Jazeera that Ilhan Omar, who's one of the members of the Fraud Squad. This has been, you know, unearthed and is being replayed, and I think for good reason. Let's listen.
A lot of conservatives in particular would say that the rise in Islamophobia is a result not of hate, but of fear, a legitimate fear, they say, of quote-unquote jihadist terrorism, whether it's Fort Hood or San Bernardino or the recent truck attack in New York. What do you say to them?
I would say our country should be more fearful of white men across our country, because they are actually causing most of the deaths within this country. We should be profiling, monitoring, and creating policies to fight the radicalization of white men.
That's how they've turned it. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's a complete deflection, and that's what she continues to do. And the left won't call her out for it, or at least when they do, it's really half-hearted. But she's on numerous occasions been given the opportunity to denounce Al-Qaeda, to denounce terrorism, and all the time she seems to sideswipe it in a very tricky and shifty way, and it's bothersome. But, you know, as conservatives, if we point that out, then all of a sudden we're labeled into silence, and we can't talk about it, or we're horrible people. And that's, again, just the double standard, the only standard the left operates by. We just have to be strong and smart enough to say we're not going to play by those rules.
Well, and the New York Times today gives her yet another platform for her hate. She writes a piece called, "It is not enough to condemn Trump's racism. The nation's ideals are under attack, and it's up to us to defend them." I don't think a lot of people listen to her and think, oh, boy, she's standing up for America's ideals. I think kind of the opposite. She's kind of the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, you know, they all are. And that's the thing that I think that Trump has been doing so masterfully is really making sure that the squad, AOC plus three, are in the forefront. Because if the American people truly hear what they have to say and what they think about this country, and those who think like them think about this country and Trump supporters in general, I think it's going to be a very easy decision in 2020. But again, the left refuses to call them out because the left doesn't want to be labeled. Nancy Pelosi, she got just a small taste of it when she was basically called a racist and a bigot by AOC, and she backed down. So it's going to really be up to us to say we are the ones that won't back down to this. because really our country and our values are at stake. And the Democratic Party as a whole is at stake. I talk about this today in my final thoughts on Fox Nation, but even as a Trump supporter and a Republican, I want more for the Democratic Party than what it's currently offering. I want to have a robust Democratic Party to challenge us. This, what we're dealing with right now, this shouldn't make anybody happy.
Well, again, I think one thing that conservatives, I hope, have learned of the many things they've learned about Trump's political genius is this instinct to apologize for basically being a conservative. It has got to stop. I mean, Trump, they told him, if you don't apologize for your comments about John McCain, you're finished. And I'm not apologizing. John McCain is a disaster. He's been an absolute disaster for the country with the support for all these wars, and his trade ideas are horrific and blah, blah. He would not apologize. Okay. They told him to apologize, you know, with his comments about Khazir Khan, the Muslim man who lost his son in wartime when he shook the Constitution, held it up at the DNC and condemned Trump. He wouldn't apologize for that. Because he knows that if you once you get back on your heels and you start allowing yourself to be defined by the left, it's over. They come in for the kill. And there are too many Republicans like Paul Ryan and you know, other folks who might be nice people, but they're just so timid and they just get rolled over by the left. And Trump's like, you cannot do that or you will lose this country. And you point that out on page 110 of your book, Tommy, where you said you have a thick skin. But you're still a human being. You're someone's daughter. You're someone's girlfriend. And you don't have to like me. You can even call me ugly, dumb, or a whole dictionary full of horrible things. But the collection of things that have been said or directed at me from the game and friends is not okay. And it's not, Jed, it's not okay to say those things. It's not okay, period. But you said you don't worry about yourself because you signed up for this. You're worried about the young women coming along now who are so petrified of being disliked on social media, and you've basically embraced it and said, your words mean nothing to me. But it takes a thick skin, as you point out, to be able to take those slings and arrows and keep on trucking.
And I think once you take your first 100 arrows, it gets a lot easier. I mean, now
right, and then you don't care.
I know you feel the same way too, but you know, I do have a worry for especially the young women out there, the young conservative women, because their friends are, for whatever reason, thinking that they are liberal. Now, I often tell girls, your friends probably think that they're liberal because Miley Cyrus told them that they were liberal, but they might not actually be liberal or progressive. If you actually ask them about their ideas, they probably would line up more on the conservative side because conservatism is about freedom, which mm-hmm. is something we should all want. But they're so intimidated to even express their ideas or even have that dialogue because immediately they're cast out and they're labeled and nobody wants to be the odd man out. But I often tell people, I've discovered that when you do say, this is how I think, this is how I feel, and you're very forthright about it, then everyone else starts coming out of the woodwork and they say, oh, I feel the same way. And then you're not alone anymore. And I also remind young girls, you know, I went through high school, even in a conservative state, but all schools are very much the same. Being one of the only outspoken conservatives in college at UNLV, it was the same thing. But everybody knew where I stood, and they respected me for that. And the people that didn't like it and didn't want to be my friends because of it, whatever. I let the trash take itself out. It doesn't bother me. And it still doesn't bother me, which is why all the nastiness on Twitter doesn't bother me, because it's never bothered me. So it's a pattern we have to set up from, hopefully from a young age, and then we can bring people all the way through up until, you know, their 30s, 40s, 50s, and they won't have that problem.
How do you prepare for your show? A lot of people like to go behind the scenes, and how do you get up in the morning? Like, what's your normal routine?
Well, when I write First and Final Thoughts, it's what's trending. So for today, obviously, Final Thoughts are going to be on that disaster that happened yesterday in the Mueller testimony, which was a great victory for us, by the way. But, you know, that's mm-hmm. what I want to talk about is the things people are talking about. And sometimes it's very easy when our NYPD officers are attacked with water and heckled. That's very easy. Things like that just ignite a passion within me. Immigration. You and I share that very much in common with a lot of other conservatives. That is my hot button. I've been to the border several times when I see our border agents demonized, when I see our ICE agents demonized for doing their job. That fires me up, and it's very easy. I just write my commentaries, and I oftentimes just do it on my notes on my phone, and that's how it happens. But
and then you go.
It all comes from passion.
And where did you get your conservative inspiration, your beliefs? How did they develop?
Well, I'm from South Dakota, so I'm one of those forgotten Americans, the silent majority in the middle that were often ignored up until the election of Donald Trump. And I remember growing up watching the nightly news and feeling like it never really applied to me or my family. We were left out of it. We weren't talked about. Our industries weren't really talked about. Our families weren't really talked about. And our values were kind of tossed aside as well. And so for me, I wanted to be a voice for that. And when we talk about conservative values, to me, that just means hard work, a sense of drive, determination, traditional values, and not wanting anything from anybody, but just wanting a level playing field. And that, to me, is conservatism. So I didn't have family in politics. My parents aren't, you know, in politics, or they didn't talk about politics. It was just more about being a hard worker. And I think that lends itself to conservatism. And growing up in the middle of this country, I believe, lends itself to conservatism. And then when I went to school in UNLV, it became even more apparent that these values need to be stood up for.
Well, when you think about 2020, Tommy, I really do think 2020 is going to be determined in the heartland. I mean, it's going to be the middle of the country that determines who the next president is going to be. So Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, the old Rust Belt, maybe even Colorado. The Colorado's gone so liberal. But I do think those states are going to be critical. Of course, Pennsylvania always is. But that heartland in America, I was up in northern Minnesota for quite a while in July, and it really took me back in time. It was an America that I kind of grew up in, and I was from Connecticut, but it's just that feeling, the way people treat each other. For the people who worked in all the stores were, they were native born Americans who were polite, and there were immigrants there, but they all spoke English. They're all happy to see you. Everybody flew their flag. I mean, it was just, I don't know, it took me back to the 1980s and then even the 1970s in my little town in Connecticut, where there was just a sense of unity. Even among people who disagreed on politics. And we all miss that, I think, today.
Oh, we absolutely do. And the left and the mainstream media is going to ignore that, just like they did leading up to 2016, which is why they're going to tell us that Trump is going to lose. Because, again, they're ignoring all those people in the middle who are sick of being called racist and intolerant and bigoted just because we want to come first in our own country. That shouldn't be a radical notion. The fact that the left and the mainstream media has made it one is why they will continue to lose elections. But I do worry, Laura, about after Trump, after the Trump era.
Yeah, what next?
You mentioned, that's the thing, is we can't go back to a John McCain or a Mitt Romney because we will lose.
God.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who we have up next, but I hope that Republicans out there are taking note, because we need someone who's like Donald Trump. They're never going to be like Donald Trump because he's very unique, but hopefully they can fight like Donald Trump. Because if we don't have that, we're not only going to lose elections, but we're going to lose this party.
Yeah, I agree. Tommy, it's great to talk to you. Congrats on the book and on your Fox Nation show. Tommy Lahren, the book is Never Play Dead, How the Truth Makes You Unstoppable. It's our featured selection on our Facebook page, LauraIngram.com. Tommy, you have a great rest of the week. This is the best of the Laura Ingram podcast. They say home is where the heart is, and the reality is home is where all of your precious belongings are, but most importantly, your family. So when you protect the most precious investment, go to the nation's number one smart home security provider, ADT. They can provide everything from video doorbells, indoor and outdoor cameras, smart locks, and lights, all controlled from your ADT app or the sound of your voice. Peace of mind is priceless. Just visit ADT.com. That's ADT.com. Safety, security, and protection are just a click away at ADT.com.
A new report shows the U.S. birth rate is the lowest in 30 years. At age 40, freelance writer Jennifer Chesick is happy with her decision not to have children.
I love the spontaneity of being able to go and do what I want to do. I love work. I'm kind of like a workaholic. I think I just had a lot of other aspirations in mind. I mean, babies are a lot of work.
Well, I'll attest to that. They are a lot of work. That's true. Interesting dynamic that we're seeing in the United States, with a couple of different big factors adding to this dynamic, where people are having fewer children and the birth rate is declining as well. What is this all about? Is it personal decisions or is it environmental? Is it just the way the society is today? Are we becoming more selfish and more self-centered? We all tend to be self-centered, but is it worse today than it was, let's say, 25 years ago, 30 years ago? If the fertility rate goes down, if our population ultimately birth rate begins to decline, we would then find ourselves at some point in a situation like Russia is in, where your civilization is basically evaporating over time. You don't replenish the population. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast, big issues, funny issues, cultural issues, political issues. We're tackling a lot today. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and you can keep up to date with the topics that we're covering, and you'll be able to participate in these podcasts every day when you want it, when you like the topics. We thought we'd bring on someone who's written about this and studied this and wrote a really interesting piece a few months back in The Federalist. Lyman Stone is a fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, and he's been looking at this fertility trend. He used to work as an economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, so he's that background as well. And we thought we'd find out what the heck's going on here. Lyman, how are you? Good to talk to you.
I'm well. How are you?
I'm very well. You know, the impulse when you hear a soundbite like that from someone who's 40 is to judge the person, like make a judgment, which is not helpful, I don't think. I mean, what is that going to get us? It's not going to get us to any real conclusions about this. That's one person. People make all sorts of decisions and decide what to do, what they want with their own lives. Conservatives don't want government to tell people they have to have a certain number of kids.
Absolutely.
But tell us what the foundational story is right now when it comes to our population. Because I remember back in the 70s, Lyman, when I was a kid, I remember hearing about the world population, and gosh, we're going to have so many people, we won't have enough room for them. And they painted all these
– The population
bomb. The time bomb of the population. Yeah. And so what's the real scoop here?
Well, the scoop is that we defused the bomb, that fertility fell around the world. But one place that it didn't fall as much was in the United States, actually. American fertility remained comparatively high versus other developed countries. That has now changed really in the last 10 years. We've gone from being one of the highest fertility countries in the developed world to below average, and we are still falling faster than other countries. The average number of births that a woman has fallen from about 2.1 in America, which we consider replacement rate so it can sustain the population, to now we're at about 1.7 kids per woman and still falling. And in some parts of the U.S., it's considerably lower than that. Puerto Rico fertility is at one child per woman. So it can go quite low. We don't know quite what the bottom will be yet.
Well, yeah, we have a vibrant economy. Maybe we'll see some changes there. Some people cite economic reasons for not having children. And I hear this a lot when I talk to my friends in their 20s, just gotten married, like, well, we want to have two kids or three kids. And I said, I'm looking at it from a different perspective in life, but I wish I could have more kids. I wish if I were in a different situation, I was younger, and I would love to have five, six, seven kids. It's just fun. Life is more fun with more kids. That's my personal opinion.
And you know, that opinion is shared by most Americans. The average number of kids that most Americans say they want to have, or that they consider ideal to have, is actually rising. People aren't turning against having children on average. Now, yeah, you get some people who are prioritizing having a totally child-free life, but they're basically being compensated for by people on the other side who want to have bigger families. So we're not seeing people turn away from the idea of having children in principle. We're seeing what we might call distractions and obstacles and hurdles along the way to achieving those ideals. And that can include economic factors, like you said. It can also include cultural ones.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Well, the simplest thing is about marriage. The main driver of reduced fertility is delayed and reduced marriage. That is, if we know that you're married, then we know you're way more likely to have a child in a given year than an unmarried person of the same age, race, and educational background. Being married makes people baby crazy.
So
I
with
guess.
The decline of marriage, you have fewer kids. So you have fewer right. kids, fewer marriages, declining mm-hmm. birth rate. You also have, of course, contraception. The rise of sure. contraception, the rise of chemical abortion, the rise of the implants, mm-hmm. hormone implants that prevent women and even men from being able to have children, father children. So some
are more influential than others. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of research on the historic introduction of contraception, and its effects are actually a lot smaller than the Planned Parenthood advertising would lead you to believe. Most of the historic decline in American fertility wasn't due to changes in contraception. Now, where we do see a change now is, like
that.
You mentioned,
yeah, I don't get implants. That though. Yeah, Lamin, I don't get that though, because when people, like my mother had me when she was 45, 46, and I was a quote mm-hmm. mistake, you know, right?
Yeah.
So now a lot of people are like, well, just get rid of that.
Sure.
I mean,
well, there's a simple way we can test this.
Yeah.
You know, different places had access to birth control to the pill back in the 60s and 70s at different times. It actually, the rollout didn't all happen at once. And so what economists have done is they've looked, well, okay, when the pill started to arrive in a place because it was now prescribable and there was actually the government supported prescribing of the pill and continues to. We can ask, well, okay, what effect does it have on fertility? And what we can see is the fertility decline in places that got the pill later was actually pretty similar to places that got the pill earlier. Now, it did have some effect. It wasn't no effect. But most of the decline was because Americans changed their values. That is, people actually said they wanted fewer children.
Yeah, so a more libertine society, a less traditional – let's just – get down to brass tacks here. Mm-hmm. If you move away from traditional family structures, you're going to have fewer kids, correct? If once family is kind of fungible and does every, you know, modern family, different families, two fathers,
yeah.
three fathers, two moms, one mom like me. I mean, then it's just mm-hmm. a different deal. I mean, it's just you're
sure.
going to not have the traditional big families. And I would say there are a lot of people who look down on big families. There's a bias
absolutely.
Against big families. Every time you say you have big family, people look at you like you're a freak. Instead of yeah. it used to be the other way around. If you were not married by the time you were 50 or 40, you were the yeah. outlier. I mean, a freak,
yeah, yeah.
but you were the outlier.
No,
now
I mean,
it's, oh, that's weird. You
change
I mean,
family structure is a huge part of this story.
I want to play a soundbite. Hold on. I want to play a soundbite
yeah.
before I let you go. Dr. Hans-Peter Kohler, this is back in last summer on PBS, saying how this whole low fertility rate thing ain't no big thing.
The U.S. stood out among high-income countries as one that had relatively high fertility. And the Great Recession changed that. And across many high-income countries, the recession resulted in declining fertility rates. The really surprising part is that we've now been quite some years through the recession and unemployment rates is very low and that trend hasn't changed. So these low fertility rates, despite relatively good economic conditions, are really surprising. I wouldn't argue that they're a disaster or particularly worrisome. I would argue that the U.S. demographics in general continue to be relatively healthy, at least compared to many other high-income countries.
So not a disaster. Do you agree?
No, I do not agree. Healthy relative to other high-income countries is an incredibly low bar. If you look at the long-run demographic projections for most of, say, Southern Europe or even actually much of Northern Europe as well, saying we're going to do better than the train wreck that is on display there is not saying much. Our better performance will nonetheless necessitate massive changes to our long-run obligations like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It will drastically increase inequality. It will reduce social mobility. It will reduce dynamism and innovation in the economy. We will be looking at serious negative consequences. And that's the consensus of essentially every piece of economic research that has attempted to explore this question.
Well, is there a rainbow at the end of the horizon here? I mean, is there any way out of this?
Is there a way out of it? Sure. I mean, the way out is have more kids. So how do we do that? Well, One way is there is an economic story here. Yes, employment has improved, but household net worth has not. If you look at the net worth of young families, it hasn't recovered. There's been no recovery in young people's net worth since the recession, and net worth matters more than employment.
Yeah, that's huge. So also wages, though. If wages go up, which a lot of these a lot of these libertarians don't like rising wages because they want to keep bringing new people into the country to keep wages low. They don't really like the idea of rising wages. But if you have rising wages, people are more optimistic. People are more likely to probably want to have bigger families.
Well, they would hope it would work that way. But in practice, it's not quite so simple, right? So rising wages, they can free up a family's budget. But what they don't do is but the other effect that they have is that they make losing that income even harder.
Yeah, I see your point. Right?
So
you become
the
more
opportunity
selfish.
Cost yeah. rises as yeah. well.
You become more selfish. You don't want to take the time off from work, especially if you're a woman. You're making good money. The idea of staying home and taking care of kids, which a lot of women still would like to do for some period of time, maybe becomes more difficult.
Well, a majority of women say they'd like to spend at least part of their life as a full-time
homemaker. But getting to the point of this, how do we change the way people think about this then? I mean, it seems like we need as much as anything, a spiritual renewal in the country as well as, education about why this is not good overall. I mean, people are going to act in self-interested ways. People always have throughout the course of human history.
So I would say that there's sort of three angles of attack here, and they basically amount to community, education, and then sort of just policy, right? So the first one is community. We can talk about people, they should get married, they should have kids, all these things. We can talk and talk and talk, but that doesn't mean anything. What actually means something is stepping up and doing something. Culture and community is not about what you say, it's about what you do. So if we say people should have kids, but we never offer to babysit the infants and children of families that just had their first or their
takes
second
a village.
Kid,
takes
then
a village.
We're not serious, right? You've got to actually step up. Your church should be doing these things. Your community should be helping young families, should be helping young people meet each other, helping young people get married, helping them find suitable housing, helping them manage childbearing. You mentioned family structure. I fully believe that the shift away from the traditional family has reduced fertility. And the traditional family means uncles, aunts, grandparents, the person across the street, the person down the road that you know. At the end of the day, the nuclear family, meaning just two parents being the sole caretakers of children, that's not how humanity has survived for thousands of years.
No, you're right.
That's not how God intended it.
I always say this to my brother Jimmy. I say, I just wish we all lived near each other. I wish it was easier. Like I have friends who live near their family. My friends in Minnesota, their brothers, their parents. They have the grandkids there. They all live within, and I joke about it. I'm like, I can't even imagine that. They all live, it's the Wheatons, David Wheaton's
family.
They
still live in the village.
They all live within maybe 5 miles of each other, and they love it. No, but they love it. And it really is a healthy dynamic. And I'm jealous of people who have that. I don't have that. I have friends. My friends are my family, but I do have the means, which is I'm blessed to have that. And I do have really good friends who have given me really great advice. And sometimes when I haven't listened to it, I've made big mistakes, but I'm really lucky. But not most people don't have that luxury. That's a luxury, which is a real problem. This is just such a fascinating topic. And I think, again, it goes back to what we as individuals are willing to give to each other. And that's, it goes back to our faith and our, if you're Christian or you're whatever your faith happens to be, if you're Jewish, we are called to be better stewards of what's around us in our immediate, vicinity. And I think, we all can do better at that. Hey, thank you so much, Lyman. Really interesting piece you wrote and really interesting trend that we hope we can actually, by shedding some light on it, maybe we can see some improvement over time. You're listening to The Laura Ingraham Show. I guess what the bottom line is, just have more babies. I hope you're enjoying this. The Laura Ingraham Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingraham.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingraham.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, Just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. Ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingram Podcast. Pluto TV is the new leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. There's no credit card needed, no sign-up required. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. Pluto TV is free on all of your favorite devices. Download Pluto TV today.